Today is Monday, February 11th, 2019. The city, Los Angeles. The host, Alyssa Walker. The host, Hayes Davenport. The sick guy at home, Scott Frazier. No Scott Day.
Feel better, Scott.
Feel better, Scott, please. Will he listen to a podcast that he's not on?
Probably
I think he will. I think he
would
will.
You?
I want him to text me as soon as he hears this. So I'll know how early in the morning he listens to it and whether he did.
He gets up early. He does.
He does. Yeah, he does. Know that about Scott. I want to open by congratulating Alyssa Walker, who today was honored by Ciclavia, the road closure event, bike and walking event that everyone loves. I bet that's the most important thing about it.
You should say road opening.
Thank you. I'm so sorry.
Street opening. It's the Open Street Oscars.
I'd like to say. Yes, you won the Open Street Oscars.
I think it's like, you know, where do I go from here? But it was so great. They threw a great party and... like I said, to be honored alongside AARP is my dream because they are.
You won the award amazing. Along with the AARP, an organization of like 70 million people. They all have to share one.
They got
award,
one and I got,
and then
yeah.
You got
they
one
got one demographic. I got the other right. demographic. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was great though.
Good party. I tried to get a ticket, but it was sold out.
Yeah.
But he brought me a pin. That was nice.
I brought you a pin. LA Pin.
2-Bit Kitchen was there. I'm kind of curious about them. It's some kind of like...
Oh, yeah. They have like games. They have like pretty interesting games that all the kids were just like whacking during the like talking and stuff, which was great. But they're in, it was like arcade, like giant arcade type things.
Okay. And they have like a place downtown that I don't want to promote 2-Bit Kitchen. I've just been curious about... I like arcades.
Is that...
Kind of wanted,
I don't know
what
the place. I mean, it's in the arts district, but I don't know what it is there. You just go and run around and whack buttons.
You did a scooter panel this week too, correct?
I did. I did a scooter panel, and then I was also on Inside the Issues with Alex Cohen.
Was that your first appearance?
My first appearance.
Welcome to the club.
Oh my gosh, I know. And I had so many people there complimenting the podcast and at the Ciclavia event and at the scooter event. So.
Oh my God.
Thank you to all the listeners who came and up and said hi. That was great.
You always tell us when you were introduced as the co-host of LA Podcast in your introduction with like some surprise. And so I'm always a little bit, there's a tiny bit hurt at how amazed you are.
I was pleased because it was something that I just didn't know that they were going to include.
Oh, it's
so
getting out there with
an
advertising
really
budget of zero.
all right, those are all my LA stories.
Scott, I think, is still beating us on Inside the Issues appearances. He's been on now, I believe, twice.
Yeah.
To our combined twice.
Yeah. He's a regular.
Any other LA stories from this week?
I was going to say, we can't possibly talk about me anymore, so let's talk about you.
What did I do? Okay. Yesterday we had a training, for CELA, the homeless coalition I'm a part of, in the neighborhood. It went great. We had about 50 people show up to get trained how to do engagement in the community. And now they can come out on outreach with us or just, do it themselves. But the thing that makes it this great evocative LA story that it is it was at the Edendale Library in Echo Park. And while we were doing the training, first a family and then an individual showed up thinking that we were offering pathways to housing. And so we were able to do engagement and training basically at the same time, not like like showing people how to train on these people. It was not like a public thing, but we could like go out in the hallway and like try and connect them to resources. But it just kind of shows you the scale of the problem, that all you have to do is put out a sign on a piece of printer paper that says like homeless engagement or something like that, and people will show up because it's just all over the city now. But it was great because these were people who we wouldn't have found doing a normal engage. We go to encampments usually. And one was a family living temporarily in a bedroom at a friend's house with no electricity or hot water. And a family of five. And a guy living in his car in a friend's car that was broken down, which in the cold, I imagine, gets unbelievably cold.
Oh,
the
weather has been
so cold. This morning it was in the 39 this morning. So, yeah, I mean, just like the size of the problem is so unbelievably huge. But and part of that is like doing an event like this at the library, because librarians have become de facto social workers. But the event overall was great. And thank you to everyone who showed up, including some people that said that they listened to the podcast. We got to get into these rats. All week we've been excited to talk about the rats. The city has become an editorial cartoon. Yeah,
we have become like a caricature of local politics.
Yes.
In this way during this week.
Yes.
Yeah.
And before we fully get into this, I want to tip our guest. We are going to talk about the LAUSD District 5 election for school board member with Kyle Stokes, education reporter from KPCC, later in the episode. That's very exciting. Back to the rats. Rats have invaded City Hall. They're in the ceiling. They poop on the rugs. There's fleas everywhere, too. The whole building is infested. People are getting typhus in City Hall. It is like this huge crisis. All the council members are freaking out about this problem way more than they did when it was only homeless people who this was happening to. And everyone has a different theory, seemingly, for why this is happening. What are some of the theories that we've been hearing?
Well, there's not one, but two stories just in the LA Times this week about the rats problem. And one kind of laid out the problem. And then the next one kind of went into all the council members chiming in about their theories or pinning the blame on someone else. My big concern is like how many floors up are they getting? Like, is there a like how high do rats go? Like in general, I just want to know. I want to know more of the scope of the problem, because if it's just like some Halloween pumpkins and some turds, you know, that's one thing. But like, are they like getting up to like the Tom Bradley room?
Yeah,
you know, is this going to affect tourists who come to see, you know, the view?
Well, where's Herb Wesson's office? Because there's
got to be up there, right?
I think
right?
It's way high up there. Like, because there's a great picture in one of those LA Times articles of him like pointing it at his ceiling, and you can just hear him in the picture saying like, I saw one. Go
so
up
maybe
into the
he's
ceiling
on,
panel.
Like, yeah, I mean, that's, I would just like, how do rats get up? Are they using the elevators? These are my questions. But so some
climb.
Of the theory, I mean, yeah, of course they climb, but
we've had them in the attic.
They're going in like the, I mean, that's high up to go.
Yeah.
So we've got one theory that they're coming from. I mean, I think someone was trying to tie them to Skid Row problems and make it about, we haven't properly sanitized our streets or whatever. And this is a problem that's now creeping into City Hall, which I don't know how far the distance actually that rats go back and forth on city blocks, you know, as far as if
they would have had to skip a lot
coming
of
in,
territory.
Yeah. Or maybe going, you know, through like going down and going in the red line tunnel or something. But it that our mayor actually had to clarify on Twitter that the outbreaks of typhus that were reported in Skid Row, which there have been no additional ones this year, were not related to rats and fleas in City Hall. So maybe that connection is out. That was, I think it was council member Joe Biscano, maybe was the one who was worried about that it was part of the homelessness.
What he was worried about. He did allude to that. And he said specifically that it was because of a court injunction in 2016 that limited how the city can destroy homeless people's property. And his argument was the inability of the city being handicapped and being able to destroy homeless people's property was what caused this problem, what brought the rats and fleas into City Hall. And he was using that as an argument that they should be allowed to do
sweeps. More sweeps and more taking people's stuff. So, but I don't really see how that ties into the City Hall problem. He just wanted to probably bring that up.
I think there's a possibility that this was a pre-existing belief of his that he decided to take this as an opportunity to confirm.
And we're seeing a lot of that.
Wouldn't it be amazing if the typhus cases that did happen on Skid Row last year, it turned out that City Hall was actually where they were all coming from.
Funny.
And so like the, you know, the little like... walking tours that politicians do of Skid Row, they were actually spreading spreading typhus to those.
Their
areas.
Patient zero, yes. Or is from City Hall. Okay, so that's one theory, which yeah. I don't, that one. The other one is, and I think they even had maybe a rat expert say that this might be the case, is yeah. the demolition.
You've got to be excited when you read these headlines this week if you're
maybe
a rat
you've
expert.
Got someone like in-house you've already brought in for City Hall, like the city's rat expert. So there's the Parker Center demolition, which is adjacent to City Hall, and the people who don't want Parker Center to be torn down, mm-hmm. I think are saying that these rats that have been living in this empty building for a long time are fleeing the premises to avoid the construction zone that's happening there, and they're yeah. going to City Hall.
Yeah, as with the homeless sweep theory, I think a lot of people who did not want Parker Center to be demolished use this as the opportunity to say that it was because Parker Center was demolished that the rats and fleas spread over to over to City Hall. Parker Center, it's so crazy to me that we still call it that. I mean, I guess it would have been renamed because Chief William Parker was a huge racist, was in charge of the LAPD. Like other than Daryl Gates was like easily the most famously awful guy in LAPD history.
Well, we can name it Rat Center now. That's yeah. fine. But that theory, okay, so maybe. Okay, so then the other ideas, some of the things that people have talked about. We'll talk about one more theory maybe, and then we'll go into some of the responses and the action items to get rid of them. But you have to think of also where City Hall is. Like, there are several vacant lots around City Hall. There's like feral cats that have been living in some of the lots mm-hmm. next to like Grand Park and these other buildings there for a long time. So maybe they should develop those properties and there wouldn't be as much wildlife roaming yeah. about in the area.
They're fumigating. They're ripping out the carpets. The carpets are an issue for Councilmember Paul Koretz.
That's the best.
This guy, unbelievable.
He was worried that the carpets would not be properly disposed of and needed to be recycled because
yes.
of...
He is likes to style himself as the most environmentally sensitive council member, even though his district is probably the most car-friendly, least housing-friendly of all of them, maybe potentially some in the Valley, but certainly they put up the biggest fight
yeah.
when it comes to bike infrastructure
right.
And road diets. And yeah. I mean, no one's even considered a road diet in his neighborhood. But we have to recycle the carpet. It's so fun. I love that this is, I'm sure, all they talk about now.
I don't really want that carpet to be recycled. I think
I can't believe that they're carpet.
I think burning it and just counting, you know, maybe doing a carbon capture type process would probably be the best.
Using it for fuel. Heat the building. Have it be a carbon neutral building.
Yeah, I don't want those recycled or
yeah.
Maybe he can take them to his district and
yeah.
take care of them there.
How many times do you think Jose Huizar has heard the word rat around the building in the last few
well,
months
that's what
and
I
like
thought.
Gotten kind of nervous?
When I first saw the story, all I saw was a tweet that said, City Hall has a rat problem. That's what I thought the story was about. I thought it was somebody who was doing some deep sourcing on these FBI investigations. So just rats, that's not a big deal,
yeah.
right? You can take care of that. But I do also want to give a shout out to council member Monica Rodriguez, who gave, I thought, a pretty great quote and just trying to make light of the situation where she said, we have yet to see one carrying a piece of pizza like in the New York subway, which I thought was...
Again, a New York centric perspective on this. Why can't we just
yeah? Why can't we have a rat carrying an LA burrito?
Yes,
in the metro station.
We have a bunch of news. A story we haven't talked about yet kind of showed up at end of January. There's a giant complex right next to Staples Center downtown. One of the biggest real estate projects in the city. called Oceanwide Plaza, a huge multi-use complex. It cost over $1 billion if it is ever built, because right now the work has been stopped on it. What percentage would you say Oceanwide Plaza is done? Have you looked at it lately?
I actually did. I went and got a pretty good look at it as we were sitting in traffic on Figueroa when I was on the Silver Line, because there aren't very many good dedicated bus lanes and there's a lot of buses that get bunched up there.
Yeah.
So I did get to look at it for a while.
It's not done.
It's not done, but it's very close. The retail could be very close to being done, okay. I would say, you know, within a few months. If
the residential tower,
you know, they have more work to do there, but it looked like they could open the retail portion very soon if they do that kind of thing. I don't know if that's something they would do, but it's not like it's a completely, you know, an abandoned site. Work has been done there pretty recently too, so it's not like it's been sitting there for a long time like a Target husk.
Yes. Now it's been, at this point, it has been stopped for about 2 weeks. Curbed was reporting this past week that they owe contractors $52 million that they haven't paid. They had said somewhere like in the middle of February that the work was going to start again, but it hasn't started yet. A lot of people are drawing connections from this to the scandal at City Hall. With council members.
Not the rats, but the other yes. one. Right.
People getting kickbacks from developers, none of which I think were Oceanwide, which is also the name of Oceanwide Holdings is the name of the developer. Were they mentioned in the...
They were mentioned.
Oh, they were mentioned. Okay.
But I think it's just like, you know, again, no wrongdoing has been
yes.
reported. It's just, you know, developers who the investigation have taken an interest in. So
right. So they were mentioned in the Huizar papers, but they, so a lot of people have been making speculating that it was somehow because of that they, stopped work on this project, but people have offered other theories as well. Like, what are some of those?
Well, these are all of these properties we talked about last time. A lot of the ones that are come from Chinese companies mm-hmm. Are being flipped. And there are a lot of big projects that are being offloaded or people trying to offload them. So it's possible that this is another one of those.
Being flipped because
zillion
of
dollar, yes. zillion dollar listing. Because of changing rules for, you know, how the Chinese companies can invest in the U.S. And people just want to get out ahead of it. So that's a possibility that they're just stopping it to transfer it over and sell it. I mean,
would they have to stop it to sell sell the project?
I don't know if they would have to do that. No, yeah. I mean, this is where I would love Scott's development knowledge here.
Well, it could be. I mean, just a sign of money drying up. I think basically, like the specifics of the rules is that it's harder to get money out of China now.
Right.
From rules passed in like 2016, I think they want to keep more money in the country. And so the money might just not be
there. Yeah, the money might not be there and they haven't paid anybody for a long time. Yeah, it doesn't mean they'd have to stop the work. It means their money's dried up and they're trying to sell it. Yeah.
But this was, I mean, maybe this was what it was like after the big Japanese building boom in like the 90s. All everyone could talk about was, I mean, that's what this is like, 80s and 90s, like when Blade Runner came out, everyone thought that Blade Runner was going to be what LA became because of Japanese construction.
Yeah.
The towers were going up like crazy with Japanese investment money. There are still in the Bonaventure Hotel, these like special clubs for Japanese businessmen.
They really are. Quite a lot of them. Yeah.
It's this relic of the 90s. And I wonder if we're heading into that now. So many Chinese projects going up, so many condos like designed for Chinese people to keep their money in. Are we seeing the end of that
right
now?
Yes, it's possible. I mean, there's been a lot of changes, and especially the investigation, the FBI investigation, has really brought to light how many of them are concentrated in just a single part of downtown, which is, once you start to look at that map, you're like, oh, this could be like vacant, you know, a corridor, you know, right around like Staples Center and,
totally,
you know, in a big, busy area. So
yeah.
I don't think it had done.
Yeah. This was all, yeah, pretty much all of these projects are surrounding Staples. A few of them are like a couple blocks away, but yeah. Another story from this week, Malina Abdullah, she's a professor, she's a chair of the Pan-African Studies Department at CSULA, and she co-founded the Black Lives Matter chapter of LA. We talked about this on the show. She had been arrested months ago when in the same event when a protester threw what was thought to be human remains into the mouth of Charlie Beck, former chief of the LAPD, at a police commission meeting. In the ensuing chaos from that, Malina Abdullah was accused of, I think, grabbing a police officer's arm. And so she was arrested on 8 counts and charged with 8 counts. And she was potentially going to see jail time. She was being sued by the city attorney's office, Mike Feuer, but there was a relentless campaign of phone calls. And every time, you know, I followed Mike Feuer on Twitter, and he, you know, he basically had to stay off there the last few weeks, because every time he would post, all the comments would be drop the charges against Malina Abdullah.
Wow. Yeah.
There was an article in The Land magazine, which is out this week.
That's right. They're launching this week. I wanted to give them a shout out as well.
That article was written by Jason McGann, friend of the podcast, former guest of ours. And The Land, you can pick up at a bunch of different places. You can buy a copy as well.
They're having a party this week too, like on Tuesday, that you could probably find out more about.
Anyone can go?
Maybe if you subscribe or something, right?
Tell them Alyssa invited
you. I said that you could go.
You're Alyssa's plus one.
But you should pick it up. There's physical copies everywhere this week, which is super exciting.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, they dropped the charges. Mike Feuer dropped the charges on Malina Abdullah, I was wondering what happened to Sheila Hines Brim, who was the woman who actually threw the ashes. I've sort of wondered why she hadn't gotten the same kind of campaign. It turned out that the charges were dropped against her last month. Her court appointment, or for whatever reason, was a little bit earlier. So no charges from that event at all. For the reasons why this happened, it could have been the public pressure for someone who, there's a lot of speculation that Mike Feuer is a politically ambitious guy, right?
What does he want to be?
I think mayor.
Oh, really?
He was a council member.
Right.
People, I mean, I think a lot of the time you think of like these prosecutors as just like lawyers, but he is a politician first. And his term is, you know, he's been city attorney for a while. I think in the mayoral election, I think he might be a possible candidate. Wants a little more goodwill than pressing charges would have allowed for, but also could have been, could totally have been because so many people were, I mean, is it true that like you can just like, if you get 1,000 people to call a prosecutor on someone's behalf, that the charges will get dropped? I mean, like,
you should ask Kamala Harris.
Right.
Was that a bad joke?
Well, look, I mean, but that's actually a great point, where I think she has gotten so much pushback in her presidential campaign for being a very tough, quote, tough on crime prosecutor, not tough on all crime, not tough on SunTrust Bank, for example, and Steve Mnuchin, but tough on drug offenders and parents of truant children and people like that. And the political climate now, especially in LA, is such that I think we have a better understanding of harsh prosecutors and the kind of damage they can do and how many people that they put in prison. So is this Mike Feuer saying that he doesn't want to be seen as that type of
prosecutor?
Did
he ever say anything about it? He doesn't comment.
No, I think on something like this, he's been really out in front in a good way on their campaign against patient dumping, which is with a lot of hospitals when they take in homeless patients, which a lot of patients at certain hospitals are, there's supposed to be a certain protocol where they're put in, if they don't have housing, they're put in a safe place, I think often like paid for a hotel or something like that to recuperate. But certain hospitals in LA have a secret practice of just dumping patients on the street, and they'll be found just wandering around like nude or in a hospital gown or something like that. So Mike Feuer was waging an aggressive campaign against, I think a $500,000 settlement from one hospital for patient dumping. So that is what he's been really pushing publicly. But it could, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting when your prosecutors are politicians, it seems like it would make them easier to do what you want if a lot of voters spoke up.
That's good news for us for a while, at least.
That's great. As all of us being potential criminals. Let's get into our conversation with Kyle Stokes. This is where Kyle knows everything about LAUSD and the education system in LA. He's just
He's been busy. He's been really busy.
Yes. And people that live in LAUSD District 5 have gotten their ballots now. So anyone looking for information about the election will get it from Kyle Stokes right now. It is our pleasure, our great joy to welcome to the podcast Kyle Stokes, education reporter, KPCC LAist. What do you say now? What do you like? What do you
That we are on Cape. You can hear us on KPCC, and you can read us on LAist.
Okay,
Think of them as a two-headed monster, you know, like a hydra of some kind. And you know, if you cut one of the heads off, then two will grow in their place. Actually,
They will.
That's what we've been told.
Okay, because they need the funding. They're trying to do that.
Yeah, we're looking for funders. If you want to help us cut off the head,
if you fundraise, you contribute to the fundraising.
You've been busy. it's like you live in a simulation now that exists to destroy you. I mean, there's just too much
it's
going
like I'm
on.
Living in a Black Mirror episode or something.
In LAUSD.
Yeah. Who'd have thunk, you know? And I bring this. Like, I was an education reporter in Seattle, and I covered in 2015. I covered the strike in 2015. Uh-huh. That was like a marathon, you know, and a sprint all in one thing. And then I move here, and then everybody goes on strike again. It's like I bring this with me. And I mean, you know. Anyway, it's hard to even compare the two events, but
sure,
that's another podcast, I think.
Yeah, so like even a few months ago, LAUSD just had the run of the mill scandals and things like that, and then the strike.
Just your average school board member resigns amid a campaign finance scandal
with felony indictments,
with the possibility of even further shenanigans related to a charter school he once co-founded. Yeah, just that
and
normal stuff.
Yard House.
Oh, in Yard House. Oh man, that chapter of that story. Yes. Oh yeah.
And now you have a special election. Then you have the strike, and now there's a special election to deal with in District 5.
Yes.
Tell us about District 5. We're in it right now.
We are, because we're recording this in the Echo Park, Silver Lake, Los Feliz intersection.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, it's a really funky shaped district because it's got kind of the Northeast LA, you know, Silver Lake, Echo Park, and then up into Atwater through Eagle Rock, Highland Park. And then it's sort of like, picture like a pair of headphones, and like that we're in one of the earphones. And then you kind of follow the headband through El Sereno and kind of through East LA. And
this is great because looking at you, I can picture this on your head.
Headphones are really, this ear.
I do pictures on the radio.
But why is it like that? And has it always been like that?
Well, you have to get all the way down to the other headphone.
Other headphone. That's okay.
I'm sorry. I should have let you finish your
headphone
journey.
That's fine. The headphone, the second, is the Southeast Cities, the Bell, Huntington Park, Cudahy, and Vernon, the kind of that
the gateway cities,
Gateway cities, I have heard them called. Yes, indeed. It is shaped that way because it used to be shaped. If you thought it was funky now, it was even funkier before. The former member who held this seat called it the Freeway 5 district because it followed the I-5 basically from like here and kind of the like Silver Lake, Echo Park, Eagle Rock, Highland Park part, all the way up to San Fernando. Uh-huh. And so like it's always been kind of weirdly shaped. They changed it because, you know, to hear the Mike Trujillo version of the legend is that they wanted to.
Who's Mike Trujillo?
Mike Trujillo is a veteran political consultant in Los Angeles. And I would be misstating what all political campaigns he's worked on, but he's been around and works on a lot of LAUSD races. And part of the reason that they changed this when they redistricted, according to him, is that it was to ensure a better chance that a Latino would end up holding the seat. And that was the thought. And it's sort of come true. It hasn't always been true.
Yeah, I actually read some reporting you did talking about the demographics of the district. I think people sort of think of the district as having in the northeast ear of the headphone, sort of a white area, and then down to the gateway cities, a more Latino area. And it's true, the gateway cities, the southern half of it, I think you said was 96%. Latino, right. Is that right?
That is right. 96% Latino in the South and only about 72% Latino in the North, which is...
But only, I mean, that's still the vast majority.
Which is slightly underrepresented for LAUSD. Yeah. LAUSD is about 75% Latino. It's slightly overrepresented for white students, which is, it's about 8 or 9% district-wide here in the northern part of the district. It's about 12%. So, I mean, and I think the other thing that's important to drive home is that most of those kids are in the Southeast. So,
yeah, it's
much bigger. And I think it's bigger by, it's like double the size.
It's two to one
South to North there. So very heavily Latino students, the voters though, tend to be white or they tend to be whiter than the student population.
Okay. So the last representative of this district we alluded to was Ref Rodriguez.
Mm-hmm.
He was elected in 2015. Am I getting that right?
That's right.
And he was seen to be a representative of the charter wing of the school board.
Yep.
Which was divided when he was on the board 4-3.
Yep.
He left office for, if you just rattle off the reasons real fast. We've talked about him a few times.
So the proximate cause was that he was charged with felony campaign finance related charges related to straw donors to his campaign. And in addition to that, he was charged with or not charged with, but accused of a conflict of interest related to the finances of the charter school that he co-founded involving payments that charter school made out to vendors that it turns out he also had a financial interest in. And so there was not only the kind of campaign finance thing, but this sort of broader question about possible as yet unproven corruption that sort of surrounded him related to that. So those allegations kind of added, gasoline onto the fire surrounding his, the felony charge. And from there, he was, he ultimately cut a deal but didn't cut a deal until after the superintendent, the new superintendent of the school district was in place. And he cast one of the, not the deciding votes, but one of the critical votes in favor of him.
Yes. And he was arrested at Yard House for disorderly conduct in Pasadena next to the Arc Light.
That was a thing that happened.
So what's the status of those other investigations now?
Well, so the conflict of interest investigation actually, I think is kind of like it sort of got washed away with the plea deal.
What about the felonies?
The felonies, he pled guilty to those. He pled guilty to felony charges, but I believe saw no jail time as a result.
Okay.
And or was, that was part of the deal. And he resigned his seat. And though that wasn't technically part of the deal itself, it was, it all happened at the same time.
Right. So initially, I think 17 people lined up to replace Ref Rodriguez as the board member for District 5.
Yes.
That number has been whittled down to 10, which are on people's ballots that they have now received. Talk about kind of who the front runners are in this race.
Well, I think you can't talk about the front runners in this race without starting with Jackie Goldberg, who's sort of a legend in local politics. She was she represented the seat on the school board back in the 80s for starters, was also, went from there to the city council, was the first openly lesbian member of the city council. She moved on to the state assembly where she helped pass marriage equality legislation and all this stuff. There's a picture of her, I think, hugging Gray Davis, signing the marriage equality bill. So just a legend in local politics. And I think an important part of this story is that her entrance into this race happened only after the school board decided not to appoint her to fill the seat temporarily.
We've talked about this on the show. George McKenna specifically was one of the board members advocating for Jackie Goldberg to be seated temporarily before the special election. And he said if she were not seated and actually ran in the race, George McKenna said, c'est formidable.
C'est formidable. Yes.
And he was and he was right.
A great George McKenna moment.
Yeah.
There are many good McKenna moments, and that was certainly one of them. And he was right. I mean, and she you know, decided to jump in the race after that, saying, I will not run if you appoint me. But I think she is running because the you know, as I have been told and believe, is that she actually believes that this is a critical time for her to be on the school board, someone with experience, someone who knows what they're looking at related to things like the teachers union deal that just got signed. That deal is going to need more money, more revenue somehow through, you know, some local funding measure through the state. You know, all of that stuff. And also, I think like she legitimately feels she is very good at pounding the drum for what the teachers union wants. And United Teachers Los Angeles, historically one of the biggest spenders in these races, has endorsed Goldberg. And a lot of the strike, I think, helped mobilize support for Jackie Goldberg. I saw a lot of like support the teachers. And by the way, now that the deal is done, you know what you can do? Support Jackie Goldberg. And I wasn't seeing that from union officials. I was seeing that from parents who were talking about how do we support these teachers going forward. So that's a big issue. But I think that she feels, you know, the upside of her is that at the end of the day, she's very good at barnstorming for issues, but also very good at being pragmatic and looking at how do we come to realistic solutions. And so that's the like that's the sell point that you hear a lot for Jackie.
She was endorsed by UTLA.
Yep.
Was she also by the SEIU is another
she was power. Not endorsed was not. By SEIU.
Okay. Has SEIU endorsed
SEIU
anyone?
SEIU endorsed candidate Formidable number two. Heather Repenning, who is you know, basic, I think is important to frame her as like an outgrowth of Eric Garcetti's political career. She was an early aide to him, worked for him as he ascended to the mayor's office. Repenning went on to the Board of Public Works, served on the Board of Public Works until recently. And the SEIU, I think it's important to just like, you know, bookmark that the fact that the SEIU backed her probably shows that Eric Garcetti is willing to at least help her, which means for the first time, Eric Garcetti is getting, you know, Eric Garcetti endorsed Steve Zimmer, for instance, the one time, you know, school board president ran on the west side from the BD4 seat. You know, Garcetti really here making a heavy push behind the scenes, I think, to make sure that Repenning gets the support of SEIU.
There's like a photo of the two of them that are on all the mailers that people are sharing. It's like a kind of an awkwardly staged photo of her shaking hands with the mayor. So she's got that connection.
She had his endorsement basically when she announced.
Yes.
Right.
And a lot of labor endorsements of a lot of the traditional trade union groups that endorse in things like city elections. And, you know, there are, you know, I don't want to speak out of school because I don't have like who endorsed her in front of me. But I'm like, these are not people you'd think would typically weigh in pretty heavily on school board elections. But the like accumulated number of endorsements was certainly impressive. And that was one of the things that she kind of came out for. And she's jumped out to, you know, she's one of the people who's raised a lot of money coming out of the gate on her own. And also sort of a surprise to me, if you had told me that SEIU was going to be the biggest outside spender on the race to date, I would have been surprised, and I am surprised. And that's what's happened so far, is that the SEIU Local 99 has put a lot of money into the race by a factor of three more than the teachers union. Mm-hmm. And typically it's SEIU kind of coming in third place there. That's kind of been their kind of traditional. That's where they've traditionally ran, behind the charters and behind the teachers union.
I also heard that she is the only, if she won, she'd be the only person on the school board who currently has a child in LAUSD as a student.
That, I do not believe that is true. Because I think Allison Bhajracharya, I think, has one of her kids in LAUSD.
Do you mean the only candidate or the only person on
the... Would it be the only candidate? Does that make sense,
no,
maybe?
No, because she's another candidate.
Yeah, Allison Bhajracharya.
But she would be the only person on the school board.
On the school board.
None of the other six current members of the school board have kids in the school system.
Yeah, right. That blew my mind when I found out that all these people are on the school board that don't have kids currently in LAUSD, but also that not even all the people running. I mean, I don't know what the qualifications have to be on the school board. I would assume that it would entail, especially at this critical moment in time, knowing what it is to be a parent.
Or either that or coming from the perspective of a teacher, which
administrative
Jackie Goldberg
role,
was a teacher.
Right.
And Kelly Gomez was a teacher.
Yes.
And Nick Melvoin was also a teacher. And I would guess that early in his career, George McKenna was a teacher. And I don't want to speak, I think that a lot of them,
obviously have
classroom credentials. But to your point, there's a lot about the school board that doesn't represent the current state of the district. There are no parents on that board. There are, people who have been teachers, and there are, I mean, it's mostly former administrators. The thing that I would point to is that the school board, up until recently has been predominantly majority white institution. And now has three, members of the board who are white.
Melvoin.
Yeah. Melvoin, Vladovic, and Schmerlson. Richard Vladovic and Scott Schmerlson. And then two Latina members of the board, Gomez and Garcia, and up until his resignation, Rodriguez would have been the third. And then George McKenna is African-American. The school district is 90% kids of color. So I think that there's a lot about this school board that does not represent the demographic profile of the school district.
And kids.
And there is a non-voting
district is 100% kids.
How young do you have to? Okay.
Yeah. But just important. Everybody talks about, and this was a big talking point during the teacher strike, was that the school board members got 168% raise, a massive raise. I don't know if that number is exactly correct, but a huge raise. And they were not making a lot of money before, which made the job something that someone would have to do while having a side hustle. And like, for instance, Steve Zimmer had a side hustle. Monica Garcia used to have another job that she would sometimes have to leave school board meetings for.
How much is not a lot of money?
I think it depended on whether it was the only thing you did or whether it was your part-time source of income. It was like 40 grand for like full-time.
Yeah.
And I think it was 25 grand for part-time.
Wow.
And so basically you could do 40 grand, but not do any other work outside. And so the option of doing 25, you could maybe try and scrape up to 60 a year or something like that. You know, I'm just kind of throwing out numbers here, but
pretty crazy.
It was a very poorly paid position. And so the result was that there were a lot of people who were either had to have a side hustle or they were retired administrators or former administrators. And that's what dictated the previous makeup of the school board. And so I think that that's like an important factor to consider when you talk about like who is representing and why does the representation look that way, is that the pay was pretty low.
Right.
For all intents and purposes, a full-time job.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about representation. Both of these front-running candidates that we've talked about, Repenning and Goldberg, are not just white. They are both from Silver Lake. They are from the same neighborhood within the district. Has that generated any conversation about
There has been some conversation, and it's mostly coming from some of the Latino candidates who feel more like they're on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
There was this very strange moment that I've had that I found I thought it was just bonkers that this happened, but there were several Latino candidates, and some of them had dropped out at the time that they all got together for this meeting. They called me basically to a Coco's in Highland Park and were like, we're all going on the record with you to talk about how it's crap that we think that none of the mainline endorsements in this race are going to go to Latino candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really, I mean, they were very forceful about saying like, this is about, we need to have some representation here. This is a Latino seat. It's important that we have our voices recognized. I mean, the counter argument, of course, that I've heard from some other people who are also, people who are Latino come in and say, you know, we've had people of various races come in. You know, we had a Latino in Ref Rodriguez is what I'm thinking of. One lady who said this at a school board meeting, and she was like, we've had a Latino already, and he ended up getting indicted. So like, does race really matter? Mm-hmm. But I think there is this sort of argument that goes back to 90% kids of color in the district, you know, less than, you know, like half and half representation of people of color on the current school board. And I think that's like a tension. And especially when you look at the way that the district is drawn, you know, the story goes, in order to generate, you know, to give a Latino a really good chance to win. And at best, they basically won half of the time.
Right.
So, you know, that is. And so like the idea that, you know, it isn't so much that they're from Silver Lake. That's necessarily the issue. I think, you know, Ref Rodriguez was from Glassell Park or Mount right. Washington, basically. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, was from the Northeast.
Yes.
The Southeast, I think, does feel neglected. And I think that I think the way that that is manifesting is a discussion about race rather right. than geography specifically, or geography sometimes means it's sort of a stand in for, we need to talk about race.
I think in LA, that's often the case.
Right.
So who of the other candidates, who is who's the next front runner after those two, would you say? Either in terms of money or just like who would you think is likeliest to compete with Goldberg and Rapinoe?
Well, so actually Jackie Goldberg has raised very little inside money for her own campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, only at last check about, you know, just under $80,000, you know.
But when you say inside money,
so candidates collect are raising money for their own campaigns that they can use to run their own phone banking operations and canvassing operations and all of the nuts and bolts of their own campaigns. Mm-hmm. But most of the money in school board races, especially in recent years, the lion's share by like factors of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 have come from the independent expenditures from outside groups such as the teachers unions, the SEIU Local 99, from the California Charter Schools Association and other allied groups with CCSA. They pour all the money in and they will spend it on advertising and sometimes even on canvassers and phone bankers as well, and mailers, and they will use that. That's really what you need. You need the endorsement of these big money groups in order right. to be competitive, because if you don't have it, you're going up against the machine all your own with your own inside money, the amount you raise for your own campaign, but you are severely limited in the amount you can raise. You can only, as a school board candidate, get a max of $1,200 for from an individual okay. or from a business. And that's uh-huh. it. It's capped at that amount for your own campaign. But individuals can give as much as they want to independent expenditure groups, and independent expenditure groups can spend as much as they want. So that's why the inside money for a candidate like Goldberg, if you have the UTLA endorsement, means a little bit less. You do need to raise money because you got to keep the lights on for your own campaign operation.
Okay.
But she is not actually like leading so much in the inside money race.
Okay.
To the list of like who's in the front runners. So Heather Rapinoe leads the money race right now in terms of the amount she's raised for her own campaign. Right after Heather is Alison Bhajracharya.
Okay.
Who is a former I think got into this race as the odds on favorite to be the quote unquote charter candidate in
yes,
this race.
Yes.
She, up until recently was a top official at the Camino Nuevo Charter School Network, which is a kind of generally respected charter school yeah. network, mostly operating on this side of town in the Northeast.
But not in District 5.
Not in District 5, but close to District
close,
5.
Yeah.
And notably, a charter network that is unionized.
That is unionized. And that's, you know, so that's it, which is an oddity for the charter yeah. school community.
Right.
And she is, but the thing about Allison that I think is also important to know is that she's had to raise a lot of that money to the earlier point about the money, the inside money meaning a lot versus if you don't get an outside endorsement, is that the California Charter Schools Association has decided not to endorse in this race.
Yes.
At least until, you know, through the primary. So if you're Alison Bhajracharya, you're coming in talking the game that you would talk if you're a charter school candidate, saying, we need to end this divisive debate. And why don't we talk about school performance? School performance is, you know, not been what it could be. And instead of talking about charter versus neighborhood, why don't we talk about that?
Right.
But the Charter Association, you know, for a reason that I don't know, has decided not to endorse at this point in the race.
I was hoping to ask you why they hadn't endorsed, because I was so certain that this was going to be an unbelievably expensive school board race because of just the arms race that had been developing in elections prior to this between the Charter School Association and UTLA.
Yeah.
We had probably the most expensive school board races in history up to this point back in 2017. And I thought this one would be even those. But the money hasn't quite been there yet, mostly because the charter schools have decided to stay out. We have no idea why that is.
I don't have reported reasons why that is.
Okay.
I'm happy to speculate a little bit as to why that might be. And what I would speculate, I mean, start with Ref Rodriguez. I think Ref Rodriguez has really screwed up a lot of the Charter Association, charter backers, that community's hopes for the politics of the school district. His resignation was just disaster because it really set everybody back. And now, you know, I think that there is a little bit of, I would speculate that there's a little bit among the Charter Association or among big ed reform backers is that if they get involved in the race, that is going to bring up the specter of Ref Rodriguez. And that would be an anvil that you'd hang around their endorsed candidate's neck. And they feel like that would be more harmful at this point. I think that it's possible that that's one of the reasons. It's also possible, again, speculating a little bit here, it's possible that the Charter Association looked at this big field of now 10 candidates and said, do we risk getting involved too early? There's this risk about making the person look like the Ref Rodriguez heir apparent. And also, are we going to cast the right bet? Are we betting on the right horse, which is sometimes what you're doing as an independent expenditure group? I mean, like, maybe that is one of the sort of things is like, we don't know who to pick. We don't know who stands out. And then I would add in there the speculation that what those candidates who got together at Coco's with me in Highland Park and were saying we're worried about being shut out of the major endorsements was that interview was a little bit criticized for this, was because that was just messaging to the Charter Association, that was politics aimed at getting the Charter Association to say, hey, you guys talk about how your schools are good for kids of color. Why don't you endorse a candidate of color? And again, I would speculate among the reasons that I would nominate as possible reasons that they decided to stay out, that might be one of them. And to be fair, like there are, you know, it is believed, you know, I believe that UTLA has similar, like, you know, kind of ideally, this is a Latino seat. You know, and I would speculate that there are sort of like, you know, I think there's a little bit of like soul searching going on among all of the big spenders right now, given that the three people we've been talking about so far in this interview are the white candidates.
Right.
And those are the people who have been leading in the money race at this point.
I have noticed to what you're saying, some interviews with Graciela Ortiz, who's a candidate, Huntington Park council member and UTLA member, a teacher and a current teacher.
A current UTLA member.
Yes,
right.
UTLA counselor. And she has done interviews with groups like Speak Up, which are charter affiliated, and sort of messaged in those that she would sort of be willing to get some engagement from them. She didn't really take a position when it came to the strike, for example, the teacher strike. Which
she's a UTLA member,
for
crying out loud.
I assume that she did strike, but you would think she would have jumped in.
But I didn't see, and maybe I've missed something, but I didn't see a lot of photos of her in red and you know, which is, I think that that's significant. And I think that that's part of, that doesn't necessarily mean that she's in the bag for charters or, you know, like is necessarily going to swoop in and be like that. But she has also kept herself, you know, sort of like third way, middle way candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, on top of that is like also kind of running, hoping to win big time in the Southeast.
Yeah.
And I think that among the candidates that we have named so far, I think that that's kind of the game is like, you know, are you Heather Repenning? I mean, I think that there's a lot of grassroots energy for out there for Jackie. I think she's got a really strong shot. And basically, I think the question is, does Graciela's name recognition and, you know, her position right now as you know, or having been a councilwoman in Huntington Park and the mayor of Huntington Park for a time, mm-hmm. sort of rotating position. Yeah. Does that visibility in the Southeast drive turnout that we haven't seen in the past to sort of counteract, you know, the mobilization that you'd see in the Northeast for a candidate like Heather, where Heather would naturally play, you know, because of where she lives and other factors.
Right.
So what will happen? Is it's a primary. Could somebody win it outright?
Someone could theoretically win it outright. If you get beyond 50%, then there is no runoff.
You don't think that's going to happen.
I mean, I don't think that's going to happen. And like, I think that the reason is that I think there's going to be a lot of vote splitting among, you know, like it's not going to be, you know, Jackie Goldberg versus, you know, Heather Repenting in the North. It's not like the candidates in the North are going to compete for all the votes and then see who wins. And then the candidates from the Southeast are going to compete and then see who wins. I mean, you know, I also don't see Jackie Goldberg walking away with this thing, mm-hmm. you know, which is the sort of most likely scenario for a 50% plus one, you right. know, we're packing it up and sending it all home. And there is a lot of grassroots energy out there for her, but there isn't the inside money isn't there. And the union isn't spending a ton right now on this race. So, you know, it's not like Jackie Goldberg is everywhere and sort of, you know, if there is no 50% in the primary, then the general happens in May 14th. And that will be a runoff of incredibly low turnout between the top two finishers of the March race.
But this is an interesting one, too, because it is a special. It's the only thing on the ballot.
Right.
Right. And so if you're voting in, it's not like you're voting for governor or something and then you're just filling in a name that looks nice.
Yeah.
Like,
this is going to be a super user election.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you're showing up, you're showing up because you know who you're voting for.
Right. And interestingly, it's because of the odd timing of this race. You're voting for someone who's going to be on a seat for 18 months and then is going to have to run again.
That's right.
And God, Jackie
this
Goldberg
keeps
has said,
happening.
And Jackie Goldberg, I know. So here we go. Yeah. Right. Like it's going to, and we were due for another election in this part of town right. in 2020. But I, you know, and that, by the way, is one thing we should say that I've heard some grumbling about around Jackie Goldberg is her saying that she won't run again has prompted some concern among, you know, teachers union allies. It's like, okay, yeah. So we're going to have to guarantee having right. to spend on two straight races, two uh-huh. competitive races in this district, and give someone another bite at the apple rather than trying to elect an right. incumbent, you know, so that's
potentially someone who can ride the momentum of name recognition that they got from the money that they spent in
exactly.
this race.
Yeah.
Coming back only a year and a half later.
Right.
Wow. Well, question I wanted to ask related to all this. We've talked a lot about how UTLA and LAUSD and the charters, a lot of this is like a PR war is kind of waged in public, just like getting as many people, as many parents, as many like residents on your side. Mm-hmm. It does feel like the strike changed that calculus for a lot of these different parties in that there was seemingly a real groundswell of support for UTLA, for the teachers union.
Yes.
And that came at the cost potentially of the district and maybe the charter association to the extent that people think of UTLA and the charters as being on different poles.
Yeah.
Do you kind of sense that in your reporting that UTLA is sort of riding high right now in terms of what it thinks it can accomplish?
Well, I think they're riding high in terms of public opinion. I think that that's just fact. But like, as to how that translates into board politics going forward, I mean, like, I've never thought that it's a great way to understand the school board by like, I mean, you obviously have to like talk about the quote unquote charter majority, which I mean, there it is a majority of candidates that have been endorsed in the past by the Charter School Association. That right. is true. That is also fact. But the charter moratorium vote is like a really great symbol of how that frame only works so often.
Mm-hmm. And this was a vote that just happened
right.
To impose a moratorium on the establishment yeah. of new charter schools pending a study about right. their effects.
A vote to call on the state to impose that resolution. It doesn't, yes. it was a symbolic vote, but an important symbol. And one of the reasons that it was important was that Monica Garcia, the current school board president, who has been endorsed by the Charter School Association and is, you know, often vilified, you know, one of the most vilified members of that board and of that coalition, got up in front of a rally populated by charter school parents, like charter school parents and organizers and charter teachers and administrators, and basically said, sorry, guys, I know you've been there for me in the past, but, you know, don't get discouraged. Today's going to be today. Today's going to happen. It doesn't mean that your movement is over, but like, I got to vote against you.
Right.
And I mean, like, I think it goes to show that A, like, Monica Garcia is a much more complicated political creature than just as a creature of the charter movement.
Right.
That's an important point to make. And it does show a little bit about how CCSA is kind of on its back foot. And I think the education reform community in general is on its back foot. I do think there is sort of this like thing that has happened in our politics over the last, I mean, it's happened very quickly over the last 3 or 4 years. And I will say President Trump has accelerated the shift around charter schools. And I think there's been a big conversation about, can you be a good Democrat and support charter schools?
One person who showed up a lot in the anti-LAUSD and anti-charter messaging during the strike and during all these elections is Betsy DeVos. Mm-hmm. She makes her way into every campaign mailer as representing the charter movement. Everyone wants to tie the charters to Betsy DeVos.
Yeah, it's absolutely true that like, you know, DeVos has become one of these avatars of like resentment to charters and distrust of charters, feeling like they are, you know, part of a privatization movement and so forth. But I think it shows it's not just that the charter forces are on their back foot. I think, like, for instance, Monica Garcia, her motivations are a lot more complicated than just about preserving charter schools. And the fact that she was willing to vote for a charter school moratorium resolution, speaks to that.
As was Kelly Gonez, who was seen as being part of that wing.
And seen as being part of that wing, but also like has been very careful to try and like carve out. I mean, that is her thing, is to try and carve out a middle way, third way.
Right.
That's her thing. And I think is very uncomfortable with the label of like being a part of this charter movement, which, you know, I think has tried to play both sides as much as she possibly can. So like that charter moratorium, it was only one person voted against it, and that was Nick Melville.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a demonstration of just how, like, when the chips are down, you know, like, we would think that charter forces would step up and be like, nah, you know, like, Republicans wouldn't stand up and like on, you know, some critical vote, you know, there isn't some, you know, unless barring a John McCain, like, they're not going to stand up and vote against, you know, if they had the votes, they would vote for the border wall. And if that was put up, they would vote for it.
Sure.
Like the fact that charter, you know, the quote unquote charter wing voted in favor of a charter moratorium is like really telling about how far you can take that political framing to understand the board.
Right. Some things will be different with the new board. Say Jackie Goldberg wins the election, what does that mean for Austin Buettner, someone who was elected exclusively by the, at the time, charter majority, the seemingly pro-charter majority of the board? If he has a minority on the board, what does that mean for his administration?
Well, so he was elected by a 5-2 vote, including Ref Rodriguez. You take Ref out of there and he's got a bare 4-vote majority.
And I believe, I just want to say that it was a 5-2 vote because didn't somebody flip because, like, after the negotiations had already played out?
My understanding
was that Richard Vladovic wasn't on his side all the way through
Was your question was is Vladovic the guy who was flipping at the end? No, it was not Vladovic.
That's right, because they were friends.
Kelly Gonez was sort of on the fence about it, and Vladovic was the for sure person.
Okay.
There are now only 4 people on the current board who voted in favor of Buettner as superintendent, leaving 2 people who voted against. So who you fill that seat with is much less critical to the abstract charter versus teacher union debate, a lot more important for Buettner, because Buettner has a lot more things to do beyond just like raise money for the strike resolution. He has, you know, up until the strike, had wanted to unveil a plan to reorganize the school district central bureaucracy. And it became a talking point during the strike where the teachers union said that this was how Austin Buettner is going to take over the school district and so forth. What he, you know, in substance, according to the LA Times reporting, you know, is proposing to do is reorganize the district into, you know, something like networks of schools that may be less based on geography and maybe more based on things like school type. So, for instance, all of the dual language schools might be part of the same network, you know, or all of the STEM schools might be part of one network. And this is, you know, closely hewing to or, you know, inspired by the reorganization that happened in New York City in recent years.
So it wouldn't be geographic. It would be based on the type of school.
That is what New York did.
Okay.
The Times has said that this reorganization is coming and would involve something like 32 quote unquote networks. And this would be part of that reorganization. The board would have to vote on it, and they would have to vote on it through several different resolutions, different pieces of legislation. And so who gets elected, it matters, because, you know, Buettner is going to have to work with this person, and Buettner is going to have to be able to, you know, Buettner is going to have to sell this reorganization plan, if in fact he, you know, still intends to bring it forward, to this new board member. Because right now there are only four people on the board who are, you know, lock, stock and barrel for Austin Buettner. And, you know, but here again, I think, you know, you don't want to take it too far, because the strike changed a lot of things. And I think that there's, you know, a kind of mobilized public that, you know, you don't know how to, like, you know, the school board members are politicians who are apt, you know, discerners of the political winds. And, you know, so, you know, the fact that this, you know, maybe we won't see a reorganization plan because it was such an object of criticism of the teachers union, I don't know. If that is something that Buettner wants to continue to do, if he wants to continue to have a strong mandate as superintendent, it matters who gets elected from that perspective, for sure.
Kyle, thank you so much.
It's my distinct honor and pleasure.
Wow.
To be here.
Wow.
I love the podcast, and I think there should be more of things like this. And I think people,
oh, we don't
I
want any competition.
To care,
only
but,
us,
oh,
please.
No, well, only us. Everybody just listen to this. But I think people need to care. My whole thing. I want people to care about schools, because if you want like LA to be good for, like, you want this place to remain an engine for the fifth largest economy in the world,
yeah,
you've got to care about all of the kids who are in LAUSD right now. They are needy kids. They are, like, you know, 80% coming from poverty. They're 90% kids of color. If you care about the future of this city, you care about the future of LAUSD. And I just want any platform I can to get that message out. Thank you for giving me one.
I think the problem is you're getting your wish, and the people are starting to care because the district is going insane all the time, yeah, seemingly. So you might have powers that,
well,
you're
not okay with the going insane
of
part, but I am okay, yeah, with the people caring part. That's,
well,
what I'm,
okay, I'm excited to see what is going to make you busy next. I think there is going to be a lot more stuff over the next year or two, but we really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you for listening to LA Podcast. Congratulations again to award winner Alyssa Walker. We will be back next week.